The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners at 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield. Today we're reading a story called The 13th Tree by R.H. Malden. So let's see what he means by that 13th tree and why we should find it scary. If, as I incline to think, architecture in general and domestic architecture in particular is the best expression of the characteristics of the period to which it belongs, there would be a good deal to be said in favor of having been born soon after the year 1570. Late Tudor or early Jacobean houses always seem to me to exhibit the qualities which I admire most. They are dignified and beautiful without conscious effort. Both inside and out, I find them extraordinarily satisfying. This, I say to myself, is what a country house ought to be. They look as if they had grown from the soil as naturally as the trees in their parks. They are as they are because the men who planned them were solid, dignified, and sure of themselves. Castles speak of violence and cruelty until they have become an anachronism. Then they are sights to be seen rather than houses to live in. Early Tudor houses have something upstart about them, as, it may be suspected, had their owners. The Palladian palaces of the 18th century are not free from ostentation. They were meant to display the wealth and taste of their owners, most of whom had probably made the grand tour. Despite their dignity and internal comfort, I can never feel that they belong to the English countryside. But the type of house which is built about 20 years on either side of the year 1600 always seemed to me to escape all these defects. One of them was the scene of the story which I am now going to tell. It is situated in one of the western counties. That is as much as I shall say about its geographical position, as I do not want to bring the Society for Spectral Investigators, or any similar body, about my ears or those of the neighborhood. I had known the owner when we were boys. Our paths in life had diverged, and for 30 years or more we never met. We came across each other accidentally in London, and both welcomed the opportunity of resuming an old friendship. When he asked me to visit him, I was very glad to accept his invitation. Accordingly, a few weeks later, on a fine day early in October, I caught a train at Paddington for my journey westwards. I had made acquaintance with the first 20 miles of the Great Western in the year 1890, and for some time after that they had been very familiar to me. But I had not traveled by that route for a good many years, and was horrified to see how the Great Wen, as Cobbett rudely called London, had spread over what I remembered as a pleasant countryside. One of the few things which did not seem to have altered since I had passed that way last was a building of really exceptional ugliness, a hotel, I believe, close to the station at Slough. For, I think, the first time in my life, the sight of it gave me real pleasure. I had to change 3 times in the course of my journey, and it was nearly 5 o'clock when I got out at the country station where my host met me. The light was failing when we arrived at the house, and I could only see that it was large and that it promised to be very beautiful. I was introduced to my hostess and her 2 daughters, and after tea in the hall in front of a superb log fire and a large open fireplace, my host took me to the smoking room. "I had no idea you were such a territorial magnate," I said to him when we had settled down. "I never expected to be," he said. "My father was a parson in the north, and I became a solicitor in York, as you know. We lived just outside York for the first 15 years after I was married. I knew of this place, but never saw it until I succeeded a distant cousin, whom I never saw either, nearly 7 years ago. He was unmarried and an odd-tempered old chap, by all accounts. Perhaps the fact that he had never seen me influenced his choice of an heir. The place isn't entailed, and there were several distant relations beside me. It's a curious thing, but this property has never passed in the direct mail line since Sir Robert Newton, whose portrait you'll see in the dining room, bought it and built the house, about the year 1602, I believe. He was Chief Justice of the Queen's Bench. His son was drowned in a pool in the garden. It does not exist now. It was filled in immediately afterwards. No one could ever understand how the boy got into it or why, having got in, he couldn't get out, as it was quite shallow, I believe, and he was more than a child. There was a daughter who married and brought her family here after her parents' death, but her son was killed at Naseby, leaving several daughters. And so it has gone on. Either there has been no son, or he hasn't lived to inherit. My immediate predecessor succeeded a childless uncle, and as we have only two daughters, we keep up the tradition. I'm really almost glad I never had a son, as I am sure my wife would be nervous about bringing him here. Indeed, I don't mind admitting that I think I should be. Of course, the village people say there's a curse on the place, but they don't know why. I can't think that my respected ancestor, he is my ancestor, if by no means in the direct line, was likely to have done anything to provoke one. Certainly, when I looked at the portrait an hour or two later, I could detect nothing evil in it. It suggested that Sir Robert had been a shrewd and kindly person, who would probably be as lenient on the bench as the law allowed him to be. No doubt he had passed many sentences in his time which we should think harsh or even savage. But that would not have been the view of his contemporaries. Well, this seems like a nice little place the storyteller is visiting. But we wouldn't be reading this on my show if nothing bad happened, would we? Yeah, that's what you're here for. Well, let's see what horrors await us, but first, a message from our sponsor.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Pittsfield Community Television has relaunched our website at pittsfieldtv.org with a new design to make it easier to find our live streams with PCTV Select, where you can watch live sports, city meetings, and more. Now it's simple to find our past shows on demand and future TV schedules. You can also quickly find information on how to be a member, our upcoming training sessions, and how to donate to PCTV. Check it out at pittsfieldtv.org.
What is One Berkshire? We're the voice of the business community, promoting the region and supporting local business. How do we do it? Through marketing, networking, sponsorships, and advocacy. Whether it's promotion to travelers and second homeowners, or opportunities to network with your neighbors and raise your profile, we've got you covered. So join today. Visit oneberkshire.com. That's the number one, berkshire.com.
The preceding public service announcement courtesy of WTBR and Lee Bank.
Hey, this is Mike Pezzo. Remember those tunes your parents told you to turn down? Better yet, remember those tunes your grandparents told your parents to turn down? Well, on Mike's Amazing Music and Oldies show, you'll hear sometimes oldies, sometimes blues, sometimes local performers, and a lot of rock on Berkshire County's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, Thursdays at noon. Tune in and be entertained and educated.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sundrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And we're back. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners reading The 13th Tree by R.H. Malden. After dinner, we sat in the library. It was a large room completely lined with well-filled bookcases, whose contents looked as if they would repay examination. There was no saying what may not have wandered into such a place, just as any oyster may contain a pearl of price. I asked whether there was a catalogue. "Not a very good one," was the answer. "In fact, I'm not sure that I shan't spend a good part of this winter trying to improve it." "You'd like to have a look around it tomorrow, I expect. A good many of the books belong to Sir Robert. By the way, we've put you in what is said to have been his bedroom. It isn't often used, but we've just had to take up the floors in some of the rooms near ours. Dry rot, pretty bad, too. But I think you'll be quite comfortable there. No, there's no story about it that I ever heard. We don't run into a ghost of any kind." We went upstairs soon afterwards, and while I was undressing, I meditated upon the strange fatality which seemed to have pursued the family for 300 years. Was it more than a series of odd and unfortunate coincidences? Are there, or have there been, people who had some malign power which they could then direct against their enemies? If it were so, how was this power operative after their lifetime? Did it exhaust itself after a period of time or not? I had finished undressing before I had arrived at a satisfactory answer to any of these conundrums. When I was ready for bed, I went to the window, opened it, and drew back the curtains, as was my custom. It was a clear night with a good deal of moon. My room was on the first floor at the back of the house, overlooking a part of the garden which I had not seen before. Immediately below me lay a graveled terrace, bounded on the far side by a stone balustrade. On the other side of this, at a lower level and reached by a flight of steps, lay a small formal garden. In the middle was a circular stone basin, where I hoped there might be a fountain. Round the edge stood a number of dark, clipped trees, yews or cypresses, I could not tell which. There were 12 of these, one at each corner and two in between. On the far side was a low stone wall separating the garden from the park beyond. Very white it looked in the moonlight, almost as if it were newly built. About the middle there was a dark patch, ivy or creeper, I supposed. It made a clump on the coping and then spread sideways in a way which almost suggested the head and arms of a person in the act of climbing the wall. I thought it rather ugly and decided that if I were the owner, I would have it removed. Then I went to bed. For some reason, sleep did not come as quickly as usual, and I was visited with the pictures, half dreams and half waking, which belonged to the borderline of consciousness. Mine made two scenes. In the first, I found myself seated in a large, old-fashioned traveling coach. Beside me was a figure very much wrapped up. He turned towards me once as if about to speak, and I recognized the original of the portrait in the dining room. Presently, we were brought to a standstill by a great concourse of people who seemed to be streaming away from some spectacle. I put my head out of the window to see what it was, but drew it in again quickly. A few yards in front of us was a gallows, and there were four bodies dangling from the crossbeam. As I sat down, feeling as if I should be sick, a head was poked in at the window on the other side. It belonged to a young man. The face seemed unnaturally pale. There was something else unusual about it, but I could not take in what it was. The young man said something in a low tone to my companion. I could not catch the words, but they seemed to disconcert him very much. Next moment the face had vanished, and we had begun to move again. I woke to find myself murmuring, "An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth." The second scene was a churchyard by night. A funeral was taking place. I could see the bearers and the men with the torches and the priest, but there appeared to be no mourners, unless I were one. As the coffin was lowered into the grave, some bird of the night gave a long and dolorous screech very close overhead. At this I woke. I think there must have been a hunting owl or a nightjar outside my window. As I did not wish for any repetition of such scenes, I got a book and read until I could feel confident that I should sleep soundly. When I went to my window next morning, I received a surprise. There, as was to be expected, was the garden on which I had looked the night before. But there were no trees and no pool, and I could see no growth upon the wall at the bottom. Yet I knew that I had seen those things, and that I had not been dreaming at the time. I decided to say nothing about them. When we went out after breakfast, however, I did ask my host whether he knew where the pool in which Sir Robert's son had been drowned had been. But he did not. I noticed that the wall between the garden and the park did not look as new as I had thought it the night before. It seemed to be the same age as the rest of the house, as was to be expected. That might, however, be due to the difference between daylight and moonlight. The day was fine, and as the neighborhood was new to me, most of the hours of daylight were passed out of doors. After tea, when we were sitting in the library, I asked my host whether he knew why or by whom the curse had been laid upon Sir Robert's descendants. "Well," said he, "there is a bit of a story about it, but all I know is very incomplete and doesn't explain much. It seems that in the old judge's time there was a woman in the village who was reputed to be a witch. Nothing very out of the way about that. In fact, you wouldn't have to look very far to find witches, or reputed ones, in these West Country villages today. Her name was Miriam Urch. Urch is quite a common name in these parts, and they say she was at the bottom of it. But I don't know why she should have had a down on the Newtons, and as nothing was ever proved against her, she was given Christian burial in the churchyard when her time came. You can see what is said to be her grave close to the north door. I expect it is. Village tradition is generally pretty accurate in such points. They aren't quite sure whether she is always in it, though, even now. I believe the rector has had something to say to old Job Dixon, the sexton, about its untidiness more than once. But he says it isn't his fault. There are no other graves anywhere near it, and I don't think there will be as long as there is a scrap of room anywhere else. No more was said on the topic that evening, and the hours after dinner passed pleasantly with a game of bridge with my host and his two daughters. We were all agreed that games are games, and though due respect must be paid to the rules which govern them, they ought not to be transformed into hard and dismal forms of work. It was near midnight before I found myself in my room, and when I was ready for bed, I admit that I hesitated for a moment before drawing back my curtains. Finally, curiosity prevailed. If there were anything to be seen, I might as well see it. It seemed unlikely that any harm could come to me or to the family through me. I looked out. The moon shone brilliantly, and there, beyond any possibility of mistake, were the pool and the 12 trees. But were there only 12? My first impression was that there were more. That was absurd. I counted them again just to make sure, and, as I had thought, there was one at each corner with two in between. But as soon as I looked at them all together, I got the impression that there were more. But I could not have said where the additional one, I felt sure it was only one, was, nor even whether it was always in the same place. And I noticed that the ivy, or whatever it had been on the wall at the bottom, was gone. It might have been cleared away during the day, but I had an uncomfortable feeling that someone or something had come over and was dodging about behind the trees. If so, with what intent? I began to feel an overpowering desire to go and investigate. Yet I could hardly do that. The door leading to the terrace was doubtless locked and bolted. I should be sure to disturb someone in getting it open. What should I say if I did? That I thought it a fine night for a stroll, and that I always found pajamas the most comfortable wear for a nocturnal ramble. For I felt quite certain, I don't know why, that the trees and pool would be invisible to anyone except myself. All the same, the desire to investigate more closely grew stronger and stronger. I have never seen or experienced hypnotism, but began to feel as I imagine a hypnotic subject does. It seemed as if I were being dragged out by some force which was overpowering my own will, and that if I could not get the door open, I should have to jump from my first floor window. This would never do. As an antidote, I began to recite the first thing which came into my head. It happened to be the Battle of Lake Regillus from Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome, and not for the first time I blessed the wisdom of my mother, who had made us learn quantities of poetry by heart as soon as we could read. This particular poem had been my first major achievement in this line. It had always remained particularly distinct in my memory because the recitation of it had won 2 new half-crowns from a godfather, and thereby had enabled me to understand, for the first and last time in my life, what is meant by the possession of wealth beyond the dreams of avarice. I am not quite sure whether I declaimed it aloud or not, but I know I had only got to the end of the first stanza. But the proud Ides, when the squadron rides, shall be Rome's whitest day. When the spell, which I was quite sure had been malevolent, broke, and I was completely my own master again. I felt as one does when a motor car or bicycle has skidded and disaster in a ditch has been escaped by inches. I stopped at the window because I felt sure that something was going to happen. I did not have to wait long. A figure appeared on the terrace. Where it had come from, I did not see. When it emerged from the shadow of the house, I saw that it was that of a young man, not much more than a boy. He seemed to be dressed as a young gentleman of quality would have been about the year 1600 or a little later. For some reason, this did not surprise me. I wondered whether I was spying upon a lover's meeting. The moonlight was all that could be desired, if the air were a little chilly. But there was no second figure to be seen. He went down the stone steps leading from the terrace to the garden below and advanced to the edge of the pool. He stood there for a minute or two, looking down into the water. Perhaps he was admiring the reflection of the moon. Then a very horrid thing happened. A vague black shape darted from behind one of the trees and flung itself upon him. It lay on top of him and obviously forced him into the pool face downwards with intent to drown him. I tried to shout, though what good that would have done, I don't know. But no sound would come. I thought of going to the rescue, but found myself unable to move. Of course, that would have been equally futile could I have got there. The next minute, a heavy bank of cloud which had been creeping up from the southwest drove across the moon, and I could see no more. There was no sound to be heard. How long I remained looking out of the window into the blackness and silence, I cannot say. Presently, I found that I could move again, so crept into bed. There was nothing more which I could have done. I think I slept more than might have expected. Next morning, when we went into the library after breakfast, I decided that I must make an effort and tell my host what I had seen. It did need an effort, for I felt very unwilling to speak about it. I don't know why. I don't think I was afraid of being laughed at, and if I were told that I had been dreaming, I could only reply that I knew that I had been awake. Somehow that made me more reluctant. However, I took the plunge. He listened to my story very attentively, and obviously took it seriously. When I had finished, he said, "I think we know now how poor young Newton came by his end. But who do you suppose it was that fell upon him? Mrs. Urch? If so, why?" Neither of us said anything more for a little while. I could see that, like Odysseus on more than one occasion, he was this way and that, dividing his swift mind. Then he said, "Yes, I think there's sufficient reason. Wait a bit." We were sitting beside the fireplace as the morning was chilly. He went to the other end of the room, climbed to the top of a short stepladder, and took a smallish tin box from the end of a shelf. I saw that it was tied up with string or tape, and there was a seal over the knot. There was a label attached on which was written, in what looked like an early 18th century hand, "Sir Robert Newton, secret, not to be opened without sufficient reason." "Well?" I said. "Well," he replied, "don't you think there is now?" Of course I agreed, and the string was cut. The most important part of the contents was a notebook. The handwriting was Elizabethan, and brief inspection satisfied us that the book had belonged to the judge. It was not exactly a diary. By no means were all the entries dated, and there did not seem to have been any attempt to produce a complete record of the period covered, which amounted to several years. There were a number of rather cryptic notes, apparently relating to cases which he had tried. Whether these were meant to direct his summing up or were merely private memoranda was not easy to decide. Neither of us was an expert paleographer, and to decipher them all would obviously take some time. So we put the book aside for the moment. There were several letters from Lady Newton from which it was to be inferred that she had gone down to the West to supervise the completion and furnishing of the new house, while her husband was detained by work in London. These told a not unfamiliar tale of dilatory workmen, of things ordered from a distance which were not delivered on the day appointed, and so forth. She also feared that when all was done, the original estimate would be very much exceeded. It would have been very interesting had she mentioned the sums, but unfortunately she did not. These belonged to the years 1599 to 1600. As one of them referred to the good effect produced by your visit, it would appear that the judge had made an excursion to the scene of action to see whether he could expedite matters and alleviate some of his wife's troubles. Underneath there was a large sheet of paper which had been folded more than once. This proved to be a plan of the house and gardens, obviously by a professional hand. You will not be surprised to hear that in the middle of the small garden below the terrace was a circle of considerable size, which obviously indicated a pool. At a distance of some yards were 12 dots at regular intervals, forming a square to show where it was intended to place statues or plant trees or something of the sort. The plan itself did not state what form of ornament the architect had in mind, but I was in a position to say trees, not statues. There was only one more paper. This was merely a list of about 100 names, presumably those of the inhabitants of the village, who were all the judge's tenants. This was dated May 7th, 1603, which my host thought must have been very soon after Sir Robert had come to reside permanently in his new home. It suggested that he had begun to devote himself seriously to the duties of a country gentleman. The name of Miriam Urch appeared among them. It was marked with an asterisk, but there was no note relating to her to be found. She must have lived alone, as the names were obviously arranged according to their households, and there were no other Urches in the village. Beyond establishing the trustworthiness of tradition, up to a point, this did not get us much further. Still, it was something to know that, witch or not, she really had existed. And there did seem to have been some special point of contact, however small, between her and the judge. At this moment, lunch was announced, so our investigation was suspended. When we felt disposed to resume our researches, I suggested that it might be worthwhile to ask the rector for permission to examine the register of burials at the church, supposing it to be in existence. So much was destroyed wantonly during the Commonwealth period that it is not uncommon to find no records prior to 1662. Here, however, we were in luck. The registers were complete from 1558 onwards. May 7, 1603, was our terminus a quo, and we found the entry of the burial of Miriam Urch on November 4th in that year. She had died on October 31st. There was an asterisk in the margin, and at the foot of the page, we thought in another hand, but could not be sure, "Under ye yew tree, by ye north door." This was the only note appended to any entry in the volume. It might be presumed that her estate was not sufficient to provide a headstone for the grave, and that no one else was prepared to bear the expense. Also that somebody, whether at the time or afterwards, was anxious that the sight should not be forgotten. We turned on. The entries were few, as the population of the village was small. We found the burial of Philip Newton, aged 19 years, on November 7, 1604. He had died 3 days before. I said. Coincidences do happen, but this seems a little too close not to have been arranged. We know more or less how it was done, but I wonder why. There must be a story of some kind behind it. Our only remaining source of information was the judge's notebook, so we returned to that. The next day was so wet that there was nothing to distract us, and as we became familiar with his hand, we found that we could read most of it without much difficulty. The impression which we had formed on our first cursory inspection was confirmed. There were a number of disconnected memoranda relating to a variety of matters. Some were dated, but not all. They seemed to cover the last 10 or 12 years of his term upon the bench. Some were concerned with cases which he had heard, others with purely domestic matters. Some were too short to be fully intelligible. It looked as if it had been Sir Robert's practice to put down from time to time whatever happened to be passing through his mind, not necessarily every day, without attempting to keep a systematic diary. One of the longest entries was a very noble prayer, apparently his own composition, that he might be enabled to do justice in the fear of God and with no fear of man. Shortly after this, there was another prayer for forgiveness of any failure. It was clear that he had been a conscientious judge and had set himself on a high standard. Interesting as much as this was, it was not relevant to our immediate purpose. We had got to almost the last page before we came upon anything which threw any light on the subject of our investigation. The last case which he had heard before his retirement, or at any rate the last of which there was any record, was of 4 men for highway robbery committed on Hounslow Heath. Their names were given: Roger Hewitson, William Parrott, Edward Backhouse, and George Urch. The first three were bracketed together with the words "taken red-handed" written against them. But for some reason, the case against George Urch seems to have been less clear. His name was followed by a few jottings: taken next day, no good alibi, identified on oath. Then followed 2 or 3 lines which were quite ineligible. Below them the words, "condemned with the others." The only other entries were purely personal. After this trial, but at one interval, it was impossible to say. Both his health and his spirit seemed to have been affected. Twice he recorded, "kept my chamber all day." Once he had sent for the apothecary, to whom he had paid 2 shillings and 6 pence. Another entry showed that he had paid a visit to the rector of St. Margaret's, Westminster. This ended with the word "comforted," from which it would appear that whatever his trouble was, it was not entirely physical. At this time, his wife and family must have been elsewhere, as he spoke of arranging for his man, whose name was Edward Hillyar, to lie in the little chamber next to mine, and more than once had E.H. to sit with me in the parlor. It is a reasonable guess that George Urch, the highwayman, was the son of Miriam Urch, and that was within her knowledge that Sir Robert had sent him to his death. Whether justly or not would not perhaps have concerned her very closely. But the judge's own jotting suggested that there might have been a miscarriage of justice, involuntary on his part. She seems to have had her revenge, if, in the strict sense of the word, she did not live to see it. We returned to the churchyard. What tradition called her grave could be identified without difficulty, as there were no others near it. But there was no vestige of any yew tree. There was, however, a shallow depression, roughly circular and of considerable extent close to it. We had recourse to the rector again, not without apologies. He was able to tell us that he believed that there had been a tree there, and that there were one or two old people living in the place who might remember something about it. He promised to ascertain what he could and added that, while he did not wish to appear discourteous, he thought he would be more likely to be successful if he pursued his investigations alone. He had some information for us the next day. There had been a yew tree there, which had been blown down in a terrible storm not long after Victoria became queen. It was more than 200 years old, but it were a good riddance. No explanation of this was forthcoming. Old Rector had roots grubbed and took it away and burned. When the men got under there, there was a girt twad setting, and he spit at they so delish. Query devilishly, that they were frit and run for Rector. When they come back, he were gone. Never saw he no more. Rector came back with him, and some things were found. Bits of bone and such like. Rector, he wrapped up they and took they away to burn. This from a very ancient man whose father had been employed on the work. He had heard his father and mother talking about it once after they thought he was asleep. There had been more said, but that was all he could remember. I conjectured that the storm was that of January 6 to 7, 1839, which seems to have been little less violent than its better-known forerunner of November 1703. It came from the northwest. Inter alia, it did considerable damage to Bishop Lawnley's new palace at Ripton. The churchwarden's accounts were available and showed considerable expenditure on repairs to the church and work, nature not specified, in the churchyard in the February and March of that year. Well, I said, that's about as much as we are ever likely to know. I doubt whether Mrs. Urch can do any more mischief if she likes to give a repetition of her original performance now and again. I expect the tree, which would have been quite a small one in her time, was necessary somehow. There seems to be unaccountable but very rigid rules governing these things. Perhaps we shall understand them better some day. You may be right, said Philipson. I don't think I have mentioned his name before. Now I come to think of it, there hasn't been a direct male heir at any time since 1839 for her to try her hand on. All the same, I wonder. I was not much surprised to hear a few months later that Mr. Philipson thought the house far too expensive and that he was conveying it to the National Trust and going to live elsewhere. I believe that it is uninhabited now, so that if Mrs. Urch ever returns to it, no one will be any the wiser or the worse. I have also heard that the trustees would like to restore the sunken garden according to the plan found amongst Sir Robert's papers. But Mr. Philipson is opposed to this, and while they think him rather unreasonable, they feel bound to respect his wishes. Well, that was a nice creepy little tale of revenge from beyond the grave. So hopefully I'll have something just as chilling next time. Anyway, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners. I enjoyed reading to you. As usual, I hope you enjoyed listening.